Hey, if you're interested in learning more about how cutting-edge technologies like natural language processing can help automate your security response, you might want to register for our November 28th webinar sponsored by the firm Empow. I'll be speaking with Empow founder and CEO Avi Chesla about how natural language processing technology can be used to break out of the SIM big rules paradigm. To register, just point your web browser to securityledger.com/no rules, one word, securityledger.com/no rules. Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode of the podcast, number 120, the anxiety about hacking of the midterm elections put the spotlight on state IT systems. But a new report out from Deloitte shows that the news isn't all bad when it comes to cybersecurity and state government. We'll speak with Srini Subramanian of Deloitte about the findings of that report. But first, it might be the election insecurity scandal you've never heard of. In 2016, more than 100,000 voters across the globe, many of them U.S. service members, were able to vote in federal, state, and local elections by email or online using voting portals. If sending your ballot as an attachment to some random email address sounds like a sketchy way to vote, that's because it is. As it turns out, online voting options in 32 states have been subject to hardly any scrutiny by computer security experts or regulators, despite many warnings about the inherent risks of email and online voting. In our first segment of the podcast, we're joined by Jeremy Epstein of the Association for Computing Machinery, or ACM. He's the co-author of a recent report, Email and Internet Voting, the Overlooked Threat to Election Security. The report, conducted by Common Cause, ACM, R Street, and the National Election Defense Coalition, recommended that states that offer vote by email or online voting options should abandon them. The report also recommends a number of stopgap security measures that states can take to help limit the risks inherent in voting by email, advice that Epstein likened to advising would-be drunk drivers to at least refrain from driving really drunk. Internet and email-based voting is little discussed, but quite common, Epstein says. More than 32 states offer either an email or an online voting option to certain categories of voters. In this interview, he tells us that experiments with email voting go back more than two decades, as do warnings about the insecurity of such systems. 20 years later, Epstein says, the fundamental risks haven't changed, including malware, hacks of email voting systems, phishing, and man-in-the-middle attacks. I started by asking Jeremy about the origins of the new report on email voting.
I'm Jeremy Epstein. I'm the vice chair of the ACM U.S. Technology Policy Council. ACM is the largest association of professional computer scientists in the world. It's over 100,000 computer scientists. Within ACM, the U.S. Technology Policy Council is an organization of volunteers, and I'm a volunteer in this role, that provides expert advice to government and other organizations on policy issues relating to computing in the United States. We're nonpartisan, nonpolitical. We provide technical advice, not political advice, and we're not a lobbying organization of any sort.
And we're talking to you today, Jeremy, because you were one of the co-authors of a study that came out, week before last, Email and Internet Voting, the Overlooked Threat to Election Security. This is talking about an aspect of our voting election system that I think a lot of people probably aren't that aware of, which is email-based and internet-based voting.
That's right. So approximately two-thirds of the states, I think it's 32 right now, allow some form of internet voting for some voters. And I say I'm using the term internet voting, even though the title of the report is email and internet voting, because as technical people know, email is using the internet. We used both words to emphasize that this is all forms of online voting. As I say, roughly 33 states allow some form of internet voting, and most folks don't recognize that this is pervasive, and a lot of it is quite risky. The technologies that are being used are developed in most cases by private companies with no standards. There's no certification or validation by any meaningful organization. They basically develop something, they sell it to the states, and the states say, that looks good. And then they go ahead and field it without necessarily any validation by any technical experts that the systems are in fact reliable or secure or anything like that.
So this is really surprising to me, because certainly as somebody who's been covering cybersecurity and talks with a lot of security experts, I'm sure if I were to say to them, what do you think about email-based voting? They would be like, that's a really bad idea.
Yeah.
I guess the question would be, when did this email and internet-based voting start in practice? And what drove it? Is this part of the Help America Vote Act going back 20 years, or is this a more recent development?
So there's been different experiments with email and internet voting dating back close to 15 years. There have been experiments. One of the earliest I read was in the early 2000s. I don't remember the exact year. The Department of Defense commissioned a study. They were planning to go nationwide in roughly 2004. I don't remember the exact year. And they commissioned a study, and the study said, this is a really bad idea, don't do it. While many forms of technology have advanced in the intervening 15 years, the fundamental problems with online voting really haven't changed. We still have to worry about malware in voters' computers changing their votes before they get sent, servers being hacked, phishing, redirecting people to the wrong sites to cast their ballots, myriad problems like that. And some of the new one-size-fits-all solutions like blockchain, which is frequently a solution in search of a problem, are being offered as solutions, but they really don't do anything to solve the hard problems, and they don't do a very good job solving the easy problems.
Your report found that in 2016, the presidential election year, around 100,000 votes were cast in this manner across the country, and obviously from overseas, military personnel and so on, diplomats. Do we have any sense how many were cast in this most recent midterm election?
We don't have any numbers yet. It actually took quite a long time to capture the data from 2016. We had to wait until various governments, the state-level reporting happened to the federal level, and then we got the information from them. So I would imagine it'll be 6 months or a year before we could get comparable data for 2018.
And generally, who is this courtesy of email and internet-based voting extended to?
It's mostly military voters. In some cases, it's restricted to military voters who are in war zones. In some cases, it's also civilians living overseas. For example, I have two sisters who have lived overseas most of their adult lives, so they would be able to participate depending on what state they were registered in. But the rules differ from state to state.
And when we're talking about email-based voting, is this pretty much what you would think? You open up your mail client, you fill out a PDF of your ballot and attach it, and then click send to some certain email address? I mean, is that basically how it works? Or is there a specialized system built up to facilitate the emailing of the ballot?
In most cases, it's exactly the way you describe it. And I should say that of the states that allow some form of internet based voting, nearly all of them are actually using email voting. There's relatively few who are using web-based platforms. It's pretty much all email. In most cases, it's not going to be exactly the way you described, because there's two pieces that need to be returned. Usually, there's the affidavit with a signature that says, this is who I am, and then there's the ballot itself. And typically, you're going to have to print and sign or add a signature, a digitized signature or something like that before you send it back. But it is basically opening your mail client, filling out some forms or printing, hand marking, scanning, and then emailing it back. So you're sending an email to an election office, and they're going to get these emails back, and then they're going to be clicking on all these attachments and hoping that...
what could go wrong?
What could go wrong? Exactly. And this is something that scares me a lot, is if you look at a state where there might be thousands of these ballots coming back, and somebody sends in an attachment from an invalid email address, an email address that wasn't supposed to get one, do you think they're going to actually catch it and say, oh, we better not open this attachment? They're going to open it. They're going to get infected by malware. And
sure,
the game is over.
And presumably that's the same user and machine who's receiving all of these ballots. So you've now got a system with access to not just a single ballot, but potentially, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of ballots.
That's right.
You mentioned that there are a lot of different vendors who are involved in this on the back end who have helped states with these email-based or internet-based voting systems. I mean, generally, what services are they providing, given that, as you said, a lot of this is just using email clients and SMTP and the internet infrastructure to send an email?
Right. There's different technologies, and some places are using homebrewed systems, but they're using systems to track who has requested ballots and send out the correct ballot to ensure, because in a given locality, there may be what we call ballot styles.
Mm-hmm.
You might have this congressional district or that congressional district, this city councilor, that city councilor. So they have to make sure that each person gets the correct ballot style. So there's software that helps ensure that people get the right ballots, tracks, makes sure that people aren't both voting in person and doing this, et cetera. So there's all these different pieces of software, and they're going to be different in different localities because everything in elections is highly customized.
And I'm guessing, I mean, you mentioned earlier, if you're tracking it based on the sender, I mean, as we all know, spoofing an email sender address is quite easy. I mean, are there efforts to do verification beyond just the sender address?
I don't know what specific states are doing. It's most election offices are not extremely technically astute, and they're very good at running elections. They're not cybersecurity experts by and large.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't expect to see a tremendous level of depth of tracking and analysis in that regard. Perhaps some of the vendors do things like that. I've seen no indication that they're doing anything particularly sophisticated in matching up. We have seen examples in the voter registration space, which is different but related, that, for example, some states block network connections from overseas addresses using geolocating, which sounds like a smart way to prevent being attacked if you just don't allow any connections from countries that are hostile. But it's a trade-off. You have legitimate voters who might be living in China or might be living in Iran or might be living in many countries that are hostile, but blocking the connections isn't necessarily the right way to solve it.
Right. I mean, listening to you, it sounds like the target user here is somebody who's in the military or the foreign service who probably will be located outside of the country, and that's why they're emailing their ballot in. So that wouldn't seem to be a particularly effective security method.
That's right.
Yeah. In the course of working to gather the information, put this report together, I mean, did you have occasion to kind of sit down with elections officials or people at the state level and talk about this system, even though it's a small sliver of votes and maybe some of the security issues that existed around it? You know, in your impression, is there awareness that there are some security issues here? Or are people just kind of, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it?
I have been talking to election officials for many years about this issue, as have my colleagues. I think some of them are very aware. Some of them are trying to figure out how to balance these two demands. It's usually not the election officials who are deciding, gee, we think it's a good idea to do internet voting, let's go do it. It's generally legislators who are making the decisions, and then the election officials are called upon to carry these out. So they try to do the best job they can, given the very limited resources that most election offices have. They're usually understaffed, underpaid, and they're not staffed with cybersecurity experts.
Yeah.
So it's hard for them to do it all, but they do the best they can, given the limits.
One of the recommendations of your report, not surprisingly, is just stop doing this. Stop letting people vote by email. What are some of the other recommendations that your report has?
It's interesting that the National Academies of Science, which is one of the most prestigious organizations in the world when it comes to science, came out with a report at just about the same time as we did that makes pretty much the same recommendations we do. Now, I'm not claiming we're the National Academies of Science, but it is interesting that they made the same recommendations. What should people be doing? What are some of the other recommendations besides don't do it? If you're going to do it, and there's been a certain amount of debate within the community whether we should just be saying don't do it and not saying anything more, not enabling by saying, well, if you're going to do it, these are the things to do that are less dangerous, sort of like saying, if you're going to drive drunk, don't drive super drunk or something like that. Or, it's a question of how much do you offer ways of doing something that's inherently dangerous, somewhat less dangerously. So other things we recommend, like using separate computer systems and not using the same computer system that you use to program the ballots and to count the votes for regular voters, making sure that all of your anti-malware technology is up to date. Ideally, we'd like to see, and I don't recall how much of the detail we ended up putting in, but we'd like to see things like using virtual machines to read the ballot. That way you can create and destroy them. And even if one of the virtual machines gets infected as a result of opening a ballot, you destroy it and then it doesn't spread any further. But that's a more time-consuming, expensive way to do it. So it's these trade-offs of how do you process things efficiently versus how do you reduce the risk.
I'm going to just play devil's advocate here for a second, because while I, like you, recognize that voting by email using our existing email system infrastructure is a really problematic idea, I do think that using technology to make voting more user-friendly and seamless and less burdensome for people is a really good idea. And, you know, on this podcast, we've had folks like Tavi Kotka on, from who's former CIO of Estonia, to talk about how that country does online voting and have for like 15 years. And, you know, it's a much different system. They've got a very strong national ID card that is the basis for, you know, casting your vote electronically. But it strikes me that this seems like it should be something that's very doable. I mean, obviously, you know, on Wall Street, we're executing trillions of dollars worth of trades every day using technology. I mean, why can't we have a few hundred million votes cast electronically?
First, with respect to Estonia, one of the things that's really interesting about the Estonian election, besides the point you mentioned, which is an excellent point, that they have a national ID card, which is a smart card that can be used in very useful ways. The other really important thing about Estonia is you can vote as often as you want, and only the last one counts.
Yeah, yeah, and you can change your vote. Yeah, that's really great.
And that's really important, because it means that if someone or some software manipulates your vote, they don't know whether it's actually going to work, because you could then vote again the next day, and again the day after that, and again the day after that. So that's a really intellectually very different way of doing it. The downside of that is that means they have to keep the voter's identity with every vote, because they need to know which ones to throw out before they start counting. And I think that's the idea of keeping the identity with the vote is something that a lot of Americans would not like. Although it turns out that in most, if not all, states that allow email voting, the voter has to sign something not only saying who they are, but also saying they give up their right to a secret ballot by virtue of voting by email, which a lot of people, if they really understood that they were giving up their secret ballot, I'm not sure that they would be quite so anxious to do that.
Yeah.
As to the question of basically, if I can bank online and shop online, why can't I vote online? That's the way that question is usually portrayed. There are massive differences. Banks routinely accept losses in the 1% range, because it saves them money compared to having to do everything in person. So they're okay with losing money. We're not okay with losing 1% of votes, especially after an election like the one we just had, where many races were decided by very narrow margins. Banks have oodles and oodles of money to invest in security, and yet they still fail, although they're certainly getting a lot better. By contrast, election offices are vastly under-resourced. And the third major difference is that every time you do a banking transaction, your identity is deliberately kept with that transaction. You want to know who's paid Amazon or who paid Starbucks or whatever. But with voting, we have to try really hard to make sure your identity doesn't stay with your transaction, which is to say your vote. And So these are three areas that are fundamentally different between banking and voting. And that's why simply just because you can bank online doesn't say anything at all about whether you can vote online.
Does that make it an unsolvable problem or just a more difficult problem to solve?
I think it's a much more difficult problem. I think there are key things that we're making progress on. Identifying voters, just as banks have learned to use different mechanisms to identify their customers online. We're getting better at doing identification online. There are open source projects, not specifically for internet voting, but for other technologies that allow amortizing the cost of developing and securing voting systems. And that gives some potential for a better outcome because we can make sure that anybody, including experts, can look at the software and ensure that there aren't backdoors or vulnerabilities or things like that. So we are making progress. There's a lot of research still ongoing about better methods of using cryptography and using, including a technique called cryptographic end-to-end voting, which allows you to count votes while they're still encrypted. Pretty cool idea. It's sort of like being able to count the votes without ever opening the envelopes. And so you can use cryptographic end-to-end voting.
You know what I think will solve the problem, Jeremy?
What's that?
Blockchain. I think blockchain is the solution.
Blockchain is a great technology. It's looking for a problem to solve. And voting is not that problem.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you on that. One of your recommendations for states is, you know, basically kind of get rid of this online voting, email voting option by 2020 if you can. I'm wondering if you see any movement there to do that or at least as to kind of address the problems, the sort of, you know, maybe kind of spackle over some of these problems in the ways that you've suggested.
I think we're starting to see recognition by the election officials of how big the danger is. Most of us who work in this space have heard comments from one or another election official over time, oh, we're not using the internet, we're using email instead, which gives an indication. Some of them are becoming more knowledgeable, understanding what the technologies are. In Alaska, until just a few months ago, anybody who wanted to was allowed to cast their vote online. And it's still the law in Alaska. It's just that by process and procedure, they're no longer allowing it. But they were allowing anybody, not just military and overseas voters, to cast their ballots. And then I think it was the head of elections for Alaska went to the DEFCON conference over the summer and saw just how easy it was for people who knew nothing about election systems to break into them trivially, and went back, and the head of elections for Alaska went back and said, you know, this really isn't a good idea. These are problems that computer scientists have been talking about for 15 years, and now that's starting to be understood by the election officials.
Yeah. I mean, first Voting Village, I think, was 2004 at DEF CON. And I mean, we've made the point that, the hacks, frankly, have not changed that much in 14 years. You know, we're still the same types of vulnerabilities, still the same types of attacks in the public sector. You know, if you've got the equipment, you've invested in it, you're going to use it for as long as you can.
Right. A key thing is to have more people involved in these things, more people talking to their election officials and saying, you know, we don't think that it's a very good idea to be doing email voting. What they hear from what election officials and elected officials, because the elected officials, the legislators, are the ones who are making these rules, they're only hearing from the vendors who say, we would love to sell you something to do internet voting, and they're not hearing from ordinary citizens who say that's not such a good idea, and they need to hear that this is a real national security risk.
Jeremy Epstein of ACM, thank you so much for coming on and taking the time to speak with us on the Security Ledger podcast.
My pleasure.
Jeremy Epstein is the vice chair of the ACM U.S. Technology Policy Council. He was here talking to us about the new report by ACM, Common Cause, R Street, and the National Election Defense Coalition entitled Email and Internet Voting, the Overlooked Threat to Election Security. Up next, the midterm elections shone a spotlight on the security and insecurity of state IT networks, especially those connected to vote collection and tabulation. But all the news isn't bad when it comes to information technology at the state level. A new report out from the firm Deloitte surveys state CISOs and finds that many of them are well established within their governments and more than ever have the ear of chief executives like governors as well as legislators with regular reports on cyber risks within the state government. That's good news, but challenges remain. In our second segment, we speak with Srini Subramanian of Deloitte's Risk and Financial Advisory Practice. In this interview, Subramanian says that states are gold mines of valuable data that cyber criminals and nation states would find very useful. Moreover, states share that data across agencies and between states and the federal government, making them a target-rich environment. As states have modernized their IT systems in recent decades, their cyber risk has increased, he tells me. It's a trend that is only going to accelerate with the advent of the Internet of Things.
Srini Subramanian. I'm a principal with Deloitte's risk advisory practice, and I lead the state local higher education sector for the risk and financial advisory practice. And my main area of focus is cyber risk.
Srini, welcome to Security Ledger Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, Paul.
The NASIO report that that Deloitte released last month has a lot of information in it, a lot of different conclusions and recommendations. At a high level, at the highest level maybe, tell us what is the state of security in state and local governments? What were your top level conclusions in this most recent survey?
Well, I think in general, we have been doing this survey since 2010. I mean, in general, why do people need to care about the state of cyber in state governments? I mean, if you really look about it, states have the most comprehensive information about all of us, about the citizens, from birth all the way to death. You have the our kids' information in school records, in the Department of Education and schools systems, to the health-related records, the human services, the most vulnerable citizens receiving benefits for child care, child support, to food stamps and Medicaid, and all the way to your driving records, your recreational activities, fish and game licenses, and going on the tax information and all the way to death. And most of the time, citizens do not have an option of not sharing sensitive information with government because they must do that. There is really no choice. Now, consequently, states are collecting, using, sharing enormous volume of citizen information. And as the states modernize their technology infrastructure to better serve the citizens, the risk associated with safeguarding this data also goes up enormously. So in general, there is the volume of data, the attraction of cyber criminals and hacktivists, because hacktivists are trying to make a statement, which place to make a statement better than a state government, state or a local government website. So it is a target-rich environment, and the enormous volume of data make it an attractive target. The 2018 survey, our primary findings are, the great thing is the chief state-level chief information security officer role, the CISO role, is extremely well-established. And this survey, I mentioned, we have all of the 50 states respond to the survey, and every one of the 50 states have a chief information security officer or an equivalent role. So, and then the CISO authority and role is really blessed increasingly through legislation. So consequently, the role is firmly established. The CISOs have an executive platform to talk to the legislature, to really be at the forefront of safeguarding citizen information in the state governments. So they have the authority, they have the almost 63% of the states said that their authority is established by a statute or a law this year. And CISOs are also improving their executive communication. This year we saw an increase again in the governor level reporting, while still most of the states, about 30 or 40% of the states, report to the governors and legislature on an ad hoc basis. A good number of states have a cadence of reporting on a monthly, quarterly, or an annual basis to the governor on cyber risk. So that's a huge improvement compared to when we started in 2010. But in 2010, the challenge was that their authority was, they were more of CIO-appointed roles. So a CIO would appoint a CISO, and the CISOs would typically report to the CIOs. But compared to in 2018, these are legislatively mandated and legislatively authorized roles. And the other point about the CISOs was most of the CISOs were really focused on one agency or an enterprise-level IT agency and had a greater amount of difficulty in managing cyber risk in a federated or a decentralized state government agency environment. And that is changing rapidly. There has been improvement in the governance model as well. The CIOs and the state executives understand the need that cyber risk has to be looked at holistically for the enterprise and not just individually at individual agencies level.
So one of the big takeaways from this NASIO report is that state governments are challenged in regard to cybersecurity on two fronts primarily. One, budget, and two, staffing. That sounds pretty similar to the private sector, but is the problem worse in the public sector at the state and local level? And I guess if they are, what's the reason for that?
The study definitely seems to point that the issue is worse with the state governments. And let us see the data, for instance, with the budget. So if I really look at, maybe I'll give you a couple of data points, Paul. The one is cybersecurity as a percentage of technology spent. So when we look at the state governments, the percentage of cybersecurity spend has been really hovering around 1 to 2% and more like on an average less than 3% from 2010 to 2018. And the budget's growth, cybersecurity budget growth on absolute budget, has been fairly small as well. And some states it stagnated. And for instance, between 2016 and 2018, only two states got more or additional budget. And I made a comparison to the federal agencies. So if I look at the percentage of cybersecurity spend as part of technology, most of the federal agencies spend about 5 to 25% of their technology budget, or at least the top civil agencies. So I'm not even comparing the Department of Defense and any Department of Homeland Security and those agencies. Mostly the civil agencies, they are still spending a lot more as a percentage and as an absolute value. Now compare that to the private sector. Most of the private sector, the research analysts, Gartner, Forrester, and others would say spend anywhere from 8 to 15% of the overall technology on cyber. While there is no absolute right number, a recent study by Forrester in 2017 put that number for US-based organization to be as high as 28%. So private sector and federal agencies seem to have made much longer, better strides in being able to get additional resources in terms of budget. When we ask the question about state government, how many states even separate out cybersecurity as a budget line item? Less than 50% of the states do it. So to begin with, there is not a visibility of how much cyber budget is being allocated in a state government enterprise level. And that particular aspect of of separating out cybersecurity budget, I believe, certainly helped in the federal agencies because of the White House budget requires that all of the federal agencies to separate out cybersecurity as a line item. I mean, while the federal agencies and private sector still has enormous amount of risks to mitigate, the visibility of the budget or the lack thereof is not as high in the state government sector. And my last point is this survey in 2018, the state CISOs indicate that when federal requirements, I mean, as you know, most of the state agencies that share information with the federal government are required to follow certain security requirements. And most of the states are saying those requirements are much more effectively implemented when federal government funds them. So when the Affordable Care Act and health insurance related initiatives and programs were implemented in the last 4 or 5 years, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, they provided new requirements for security, but they also provided funding to implement those requirements. And the states actually moved the ball forward in those instances. So maybe looking at those kind of opportunities as part of program modernization, getting adequate cyber funding from federal agencies is one way to perhaps attack this issue. So we actually call this advocating for a dedicated program, cyber program funding, as a bold play that the states have to take up, citizens.
As we look at the states, you know, you talked about their being a valuable target based on how much data and the different diversity of data they hold on their citizens. What are the major risks that you see states addressing? What are their top of mind security concerns?
So the survey in 2018 points out that the top of the mind concern is web applications. So it is really moved from 2010, when a lot of focus was on perimeter security, to now the web-based applications that are mm-hmm. serving the needs of the citizen. So the CISOs put that as one of the top concern. Of course, ransomware, phishing, and some of the other threats are they rank pretty high as well. Now, if you really look at the the emerging trends, now one of the things that having worked in state governments for over 18 years, state governments are very good about adapting and implementing new technologies. In early 2000s, it was about taking applications, citizen serving applications, and making them accessible on the internet. And today, it is about using modern technologies like IoTs and smart sensors and so forth, and smart city and smart state kind of initiatives. So states are not lagging behind as much as one would think in terms of adopting new technologies, but the risk kind of exponentially increases as the new technologies are embraced. And the concern or the risk, in addition to the point that you made about look, states have a large volume of sensitive information, and the volume keeps increasing as they start embracing some of the new technologies and innovations to better serve the citizens. Now, the concern that I would translate that to is, as these new initiatives are embarked upon, the nature of cyber risk needs to be better understood, and perhaps that's an opportunity for the CISOs to really become the enablers of these innovations in the state. And when states are doing it the first time, they do it with the right level of security controls and measures. So one of the second bold play that we actually highlighted in the report is, look, why wouldn't the CISOs become the proponents and enablers of this of those innovative ideas, rather than coming across as talking about the risks as to why an initiative cannot move forward, but really working with the business to enable those initiatives, but do the security right the first time. So I think there are some opportunities in the smart sensors and IoTs and artificial intelligence and those kind of areas. And we actually pointed out in the survey that those innovation initiatives are not the top of the mind initiatives for the state CISOs. The state CISOs listed in their top five priorities items that you would expect a CISO to focus on, like cybersecurity strategy, training and awareness, metrics to measure and report effectiveness and risk assessment, but they were not really spending as much time on the blockchain or the Internet of Things or citizen digital identity and so forth. So our bold play number two was perhaps the CISOs become an enabler of innovation, and by doing that, they get much closer to the business and program leaders, and they are able to get adequate amount of resources, because we talked about the resource constraint, and maybe at least in future for new initiatives, they're able to get the right level of support for cyber.
Obviously, we just came through the midterm elections. This was put a lot of focus on state secretaries of state office and the security of infrastructure, web applications, and so on that are involved in vote tabulation and reporting. Blessedly for all of us, not many stories about cyber attacks or other online shenanigans. So what should we take away from that, Srini? Was that a test passed by the states, or should we not read too much into the fact that there weren't any major cyber-related incidents around the midterm?
Well, it's always a good thing when we don't hear major disruption and incidents.
Not getting hacked is always a good thing.
It's always a good thing. The other good thing is the fact that the states, there was enormous amount of attention by the business leaders and the program leaders to the cyber aspects, and the fact that the state level executives were spending a lot of time working, collaborating with the Federal Department of Homeland Security to understand the threats, and collaborating with the local governments, because the election infrastructure is extremely distributed and very diverse set of infrastructure. So I think it forced a greater deal of collaboration and elevation of the cyber awareness. I think that's an overall positive. It's always great not to hear about huge impact right after an event like this.
I wonder in some ways if that does that become the template for greater cooperation or coordination around cybersecurity, both across state departments, but also between the state and federal governments. Securing the elections may be a little bit of a InfoSec beachhead for states in terms of improving their overall cybersecurity posture.
I certainly hope so. I think that is that actually gives you the recipe for continued collaboration in other areas where, we were just talking about the IoTs and modern technologies and how do you embrace them securely, and even to the point of the local governments that could not afford to have their own cyber infrastructure and security measures, how they can start collaborating more with the state enterprise and transcending some of the jurisdictional boundaries that that always prevented this kind of collaboration in the past. I think this is a great opportunity to break through some of those barriers and increasingly do more with less resources.
Obviously, the growth of Internet of Things and smart city, smart infrastructure investments that many states are making and are certainly due to make in the next 10 to 20 years. Those are really going to increase the complexity and scope of state IT operations and also expand the risk, right, that goes cyber risk that goes along with those. Is there any sense that state CISOs are on top of that challenge or that we're going to see the role of the state CISO expand as the Internet of Things expands?
Paul, that's a great question. I believe that there is an opportunity for the CISO role to expand because let's consider this. At this point, when most of the time we talk about the threat to information, it is threat to the data. The data gets stolen, and there is a resiliency and recovery operation that needs to happen. When the operational technology that operates critical infrastructure, transportation systems, and signaling systems, and so forth, when the threat is to the operational infrastructure as opposed to the IT, then the enormity of the impact of such a disruption is something that is going to get much more attention from the lawmakers and the state leaders. And consequently, there is going to be a lot more focus on making sure that the transportation systems and utilities and others are operating as they should, and they have adequate amount of risk mitigation procedures in place. So I believe there is an opportunity for the CIOs and CISOs to really start collaborating in those areas, because, I mean, obviously they're going to get more attention in terms of an issue, even affecting a small town or municipality. One interesting aspect in the state governments is a lack of an enterprise risk officer position, which most of the private sectors have an enterprise level risk chief risk officer, and that position that looks at the risk holistically at a business level seems largely absent in state governments. And the privacy officers at an enterprise level, only 18 of the states have a privacy officer, or even less than that. In this survey, we found that the number of states having a privacy officer is not that many as well. And so why is that relevant? I believe to continue to elevate the cyber risk to the lawmakers and executives, having more than one executive, like a chief security officer and CIO, and if there are privacy officers and risk officers highlighting similar risks, I think it would help move the needle faster or more. I mentioned about chief privacy officers. Only 14 states have a chief privacy officer role at an enterprise level. If there is a chief privacy officer who is talking to the business leaders on the need to protect certain information, because the chief security officers are always talking about the what and how to protect that and what they need to protect that information, and if there is a privacy officer always talking about the why and why is it required to do certain thing from a business language, it would help move the needle forward.
Srini, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Paul, great. Thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. And have a great day.
Srini Subramanian is a principal with the Deloitte Risk Advisory Practice and leads the state, local, and higher ed sector. He was talking to us about the 2018 Deloitte NASIO Cybersecurity Study, which was released in October.